It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress. This week, the Keystone XL pipeline and immigration measures are under heated debate.
First, the latest Burden of Tobacco report from UW-Milwaukee shows that the price of tobacco use, both in health costs and loss of productivity, have continued to rise.
The estimated annual costs are now at $4.6 billion, a cost that's equal to about $528 a year for every person in the state. As the debate on the state budget heats up, supporters of smoking cessation programs say getting people to quit can make economic sense for Wisconsin.
Here with us now is Sarah Solly, Wisconsin Government Relations Director at the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, the trend in Wisconsin and around the nation, it seems, is that the number of people smoking is going down. And it wasn't too long ago that we talked about the number of teens smoking is at an all-time low. So why are the costs rising?
Well, you know, with the trends going down, that doesn't mean that all of, you know, sort of the health effects of smoking are going to be immediately seen. We're happy about those trends going down with traditional cigarettes being used, but there are all of these other products, you know, little cigars and other tobacco products that are still causing health problems for folks in this state.
So is it a matter of taking into account things like little cigars and e-cigarettes, or is there a lag between people quitting smoking and then us seeing the health savings?
I think it's both. I think that, you know, there are some things that we can do to continue to, you know, keep these numbers going down with use of tobacco.
In terms of tabulating the price of tobacco, the burden, how do you calculate that?
Well, the report is actually pulled from data at the Centers for Disease Control, and it's done every 5 years.
When we talk about the price of tobacco, the burden placed on Wisconsin in this instance, can you give us a sense of what those things are that the state is paying for?
Sure. I mean, there's certainly obviously health care costs and loss of productivity. You know, obviously the things that you know, people are suffering from cancer and heart disease and those kinds of things, folks on Badger Care, our premium rates are obviously part of that with all of these health concerns directly related to tobacco use.
Wisconsin lawmakers are about to begin debating the budget. Do you see this, the costs of tobacco on the state, as something that is an outstanding issue that needs to be addressed budgetary-wise?
Well, certainly, you know, it's timely, as you said at the beginning of the show, to have this report released, and we will use this as we meet with lawmakers and talk about some of the things that they can do. One of the things we'll talk about is the tobacco prevention and control funding. Currently, Wisconsin funds that program at $5.3 million. It's only 9% of what the CDC recommends. You know, we're happy to report, you know, some of these things that have come out in the last few months about smoking rates going down. You know, we can directly attribute that to, you know, this program funding and some of the education, the quit line that's out there, you know. But we would say that the quit line is not able to meet the demands and that all of these, you know, services on education around these products are not sort of throughout the state. And so, you know, those are some of the things that we'll be talking to lawmakers about when we talk about, you know, this report.
So Wisconsin only spends 9% of what the CDC recommends. How come?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, we have seen, you know, this number a lot higher. But I think that we've seen, you know, some tough budget times in the past. And we're hoping, though, that this program is not seen as something that can be cut.
Now, you mentioned the quit line being understaffed or the need to expand that. What would happen if you did have the person power there to meet the needs of Wisconsin on the quit line?
Well, I would say that the quit line is one area that we definitely know works for people. It offers, you know, free counseling and free cessation products for folks, and I think that it, you know, if people had access to that at a higher rate, you know, we would see these numbers, you know, even better for us in terms of people that were able to quit.
And you mentioned services being extended to the whole of Wisconsin. Where do you see gaps in coverage of these services?
Well, I would say in some of, you know, the smaller communities, I don't have the exact, you know, geographical locations. But, you know, as we talk about, you know, traditional cigarettes and the use of traditional cigarettes going down, but these other reports that have shown using things like little cigars and electronic cigarettes and, you know, some of these other, you know, clever new products that the tobacco industry is putting out, we see a real need in all of these areas that are even currently being served for the education to continue on, you know, what these products look like, what parents are needing to look for, you know, in their kids' backpacks and things like that.
Well, I've heard about e-cigarettes, and I know that the use among teenagers is up pretty high, especially in Wisconsin. I don't know as much about little cigars. Tell us what those are and why they might be a danger.
So little cigars really are an actual cigarette that's just wrapped in brown paper, and oftentimes they are candy flavored. They come in a package that looks very similar to a cigarette. And currently, the loophole that exists is that they're not taxed at the same rate as a cigarette. And we will say that these are definitely a cigarette. They just come packaged a little bit differently, wrapped in brown paper. Currently, you can buy little cigars, and the tax on those is around 65 cents. A pack of cigarettes, a tax on that is $2.52. And if that loophole was closed and these were taxed at the same rate as cigarettes, it would certainly be a price point that maybe kids could not afford these products that are candy flavored and definitely marketed and geared towards their age group.
Some of the science is still out on how harmful things like e-cigarettes are, but is this something that you're concerned about?
Well, we're definitely concerned about e-cigarettes, mostly because they're unregulated and so little is known about this product. At this point, we're treating them like a tobacco product until we get, you know, a few years of research behind us, you know, from the FDA and that kind of thing. But, you know, initial studies will show that these are, you know, quite harmful.
And how about little cigars? Same thing.
Well, little cigars are definitely harmful. We do know that. These are just, like I said earlier, you know, a cigarette that is candy-flavored and wrapped in brown paper. So they actually aren't even really being called the right thing. They're called little cigars because they're smaller than a traditional cigar and wrapped in brown paper, but what they actually are is a cigarette.
Now, the rate of Wisconsin teens using e-cigarettes is 75% higher than the national average. Why do you think that is? Why in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, that's a good question. We're as shocked by these numbers, I think, as everyone is. Because they're so new, I think we still have, you know, a lot to figure out on these, including, you know, why Wisconsin youth are using them, you know, and maybe, you know, work to educate, you know, families and lawmakers on these products and what they are. What we're finding actually is, you know, as we talk even to our colleagues internally here about these products or some of our volunteers on these products, it's a conversation that can go on and on and on. There's so much that is unknown and so much interest in learning what these products are and what they actually, you know, what they're claiming to be versus what they really are and you know, unregulated. And so many manufacturers of these products, these e-cigarettes aren't even labeled. The you know, we don't even really know what's in them. And again, there's so many manufacturers of these products, we just simply don't know, you know, what folks are in inhaling.
Is there evidence out there to suggest that teens start out by smoking e-cigarettes? As they get older, they maybe graduate to just using tobacco products?
Well, one thing I will say is they are such a new product. I don't think we have the data on whether or not, you know, these are definitely a gateway to using traditional cigarettes. I will say what they are is, you know, they're nicotine, and you become addicted to the nicotine, whether it's an e-cigarette or a cigarette. And so, you know, potentially, you know, we would think that this has the potential to, you know, get them to start and become addicted to nicotine. And then, you know, if they're following the law and aren't able to use a cigarette until they're 18, you know, maybe they'll switch over to a traditional cigarette.
Now, in terms of what we know about what works, what gets people to quit smoking, what do we know?
Well, the things that work are counseling, the patch, gum, all of these things that are CDC or FDA approved cessation devices. And so we will continue to recommend all of these products that have gone through the proper, approval process to become a cessation device.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Sarah Solly, Wisconsin Government Relations Director at the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. The group just released a report about the economic costs of tobacco use here in Wisconsin. Congress is in full swing. Legislators are back in Washington. They've been there for over a week, and they're back at work on legislation, including another swing at the Keystone XL pipeline in the Senate and an attempt to block or undo some of President Obama's immigration reforms in the House.
Also, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan and some Republicans in Congress are considering calling for an effective repeal of No Child Left Behind in what would be the biggest education policy rewrite in 14 years. In our weekly look at Congress, Susan Davis fills in for our regular guest, Paul Singer. Susan is the USA Today Chief Congressional Reporter. Susan, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So it's a new look in Congress. What has this first week been like?
Well, we're now in our second week. So it's been, I would say that there was maybe some expectation that a new Republican Congress would come in and it would be, nonstop action. And I think what you have to remember about Congress is that things here do move pretty slowly. So we're still debating the Keystone Pipeline, and particularly in the Senate, where that debate could take as many as 2 or 3 weeks if they really want to run out the clock and have extensive debate on amendments. And in the House, where things do tend to move a little bit quicker, they've already moved forward on Keystone, and today they've advanced some immigration legislation that is probably going to be another form of confrontation both within the party and with the White House. So it's been a little bit of both. I think we see Republicans trying to advance an agenda that they can pass and get to the president's desk, but on the horizon, there is a lot of potential for conflict coming up.
At the outset, anyway, is there a sense that Republicans are speaking close to with one voice? They're coming in, they have an agenda, they're going to try to get these things passed and passed soon?
Well, on some things, the easy stuff, they're speaking with one voice. I mean, Keystone has been a lingering issue for years. There's unanimous support within the Republican Party for it. I think that's part of the reason why they chose that issue to kick off the Congress with, is they knew they had consensus and they knew they could pass it. Looking forward, it's going to be difficult. Republicans right now are meeting in Pennsylvania until Friday, House and Senate Republicans, in the first bicameral retreat in nearly a decade, in which they're going to try and figure that out. I think that you are still seeing the problems that Republican leaders are going to have from the conservative flank of the party that is going to make it hard in a lot of cases to advance an agenda. I also think Republicans in the House are going to have a really hard lesson to learn. And if they think they hated it when Democrats controlled the Senate, they're going to be incredibly frustrated when Republicans control the Senate, because it's going to be even more frustrating when your own party controls the chamber and you still can't advance legislation, in part because of the filibuster and 60-vote rules in the Senate. So I think part of what leadership is trying to do, particularly to a lot of these junior, sophomore, rank-and-file lawmakers, is try and set realistic expectations as to what a Republican Party can do with a Democrat still in the White House.
Before we get into a particular legislation more, are we going to see cases where Republican leadership has to cobble together some Democratic support to make up for, say, conservative Republicans who rebel against particular pieces of legislation?
I think that's certainly a possibility. We haven't necessarily seen it yet. Keystone is an interesting case where it's the reverse, in that it's an issue where they have bipartisan support, and only with the assistance of Democrats have they been able to get it over the 60-vote hurdle. I think it's also interesting because Senate Republicans and House Republicans have almost very different charges. Mitch McConnell, the incoming Senate Majority Leader, and Republican leaders in the Senate have said, we want to look to find what they've identified as up to 12 to 15 moderate centrist Democrats who may want to join with us on some of this legislation. We've seen it on Keystone. I'm sure that you would see it probably on some of those social issues, on gun rights or on abortion, if they choose to bring those up. And in the House, there's just a larger, more significant faction of conservatives. We know there's at least 24, because that's how many voted against the Speaker, House Speaker John Boehner, at the beginning of the Congress, who are going to make it very difficult to get things passed in the House, where historically the majority party tries to pass things with the strength of their own party.
Now, sticking with Keystone in particular, the House, you said, already passed it. The Senate has it in the works. Is there hope that they can craft something, despite a veto threat from the White House, that they can craft an offer that the president can't refuse on this?
I can't see it, but I wouldn't say it's impossible. We haven't gotten a full breath of what the amendments are going to be offered yet and how that legislation might change as the Senate moves forward. But the White House has been pretty early and clear that they will not sign this and that they want the State Department review to play out. What I do find interesting, though, is that even from top Democrats who voted against Keystone, Steny Hoyer is the number two Democrat in the House, and he kind of said this week, you know, I kind of expect Keystone will get approved eventually, and I'm not against that. I just want the process to play out. So, you know, it's not been a huge rallying cry for a ton of Democrats. It tends to be more environmentalist Democrats, the outside groups that really do not like this pipeline. There's a sort of sense of inevitability about it, even though it's probably not going to be okayed in this latest debate. And I think it would be hard for the White House to walk back a veto threat that has been as clear as the president has already issued.
Well, let's move to immigration now. The House has been taking votes on Homeland Security funding through September. Republicans looking at amendments aimed at blocking President Obama's recent actions on immigration, maybe his whole record of executive action on immigration. What kind of things are we seeing there?
Yeah, and this is a great example of what I said, where House Republicans are going to run into the wall that is the Senate, even when it's controlled by their own chamber. The House passed a funding bill for the Department of Homeland Security, and through amendment, they attached to it a number of provisions, probably the most controversial of which is an amendment that essentially would end what we call the DACA program, which is the deferred deportations for children of illegal immigrants, which is it has a fair amount of bipartisan support, and this is something that passed overwhelmingly in the House, but it's just going to run into a wall in the Senate. I don't think any of the amendments that the House has looked at to rein in the president's executive order stand a chance at getting 60 in the Senate. So it's a feel-good vote for a lot of House Republicans who get to go home and say they're going to war against the White House, but at the end of the day, there's almost no chance that not only can it not get past the Senate, but there is just no world in which the president would sign that bill. So I think we're just at the first bite of the apple of that confrontation, because part of that is going to be a lot of internal Republican fighting over why they can't get it done. And that's going to be a really interesting fight to watch in the next couple of weeks.
Are these seen as freebies for appealing to parts of the Republican base that aren't supportive of immigration? They can take these votes knowing that there's not going to be any consequence. They're not actually going to happen.
Well, I would also say that there's a lot of Republicans who just firmly believe that that they should happen. So it's a freebie vote in the sense that they get to go on record stating what they believe, so they can go home and say, I voted for this, you know. And for a lot of them, it's very important, particularly when you think about primaries or going back home and explaining your votes to your constituents. And a lot of Republicans represent very conservative districts where that is the policy that they support. So, but having to explain why you can't get it done, even though Republicans control all of Congress, is a very hard case for lawmakers to make. Because I think, you know, average Americans going on in their day-to-day lives don't necessarily get too in the weeds on Senate filibuster rules and process. They just want results. And so it's going to be hard for Republicans. They have to sort of measure their message on this, because while the rhetoric they're using about reining in the president is very strong, the reality of what they can actually do in the next 2 years is very, very limited. And Mitch McConnell and John Boehner are actually pretty candid about that. They say we have to be realistic about what we can get done, but at the same time, they have to appease their rank-and-file lawmakers who want to go on record on these issues.
Is there any thought that they'll go big and try to craft a full immigration reform, or will they end up passing just bits and pieces, border security here, that sort of thing?
I think it has to be piecemeal. I mean, the sense coming from leadership for years on immigration is that a big comprehensive bill does not have the support within the party. They don't like that kind of sweeping legislation. They feel like there's too much in it to really understand what you're voting on, and that the overwhelming view within the Republican Party is that they need some assurance that the border is secure before they can even get to the path to citizenship component of immigration reform, which even that to itself is still incredibly divisive within the party and probably doesn't have a majority of support in the House as a standalone. So it's a continually percolating, fermenting issue, and I do not think that the party really has its arms around it yet as to how to address it, how to both make the conservative part of the party happy, but also not moves so far right that you start to really alienate even further Hispanic voters and minority voters who are paying attention to this issue, particularly as, you know, we're already in the beginning of the 2016 presidential cycle.
Now, speaking of going big on a complicated issue, there's talk from the White House and from some Republicans about tackling education, changing, maybe even completely eliminating, I guess, replacing No Child Left Behind. Briefly, what's going on there?
It'll be a really interesting fight. The No Child Left Behind law was passed in 2002, and hasn't been fully reauthorized. And I think that there's a lot of interest in both sides at taking up that law and doing a rewrite. One of the things that I think has become very controversial, which will get tied into this debate, is the Common Core standards that have become that have opponents in both parties, but particularly the Republican Party, who would like to see them stopped or gutted or changed. And I think Democrats in some ways see an opportunity here to advance some of their education initiatives, particularly in pre-K and early education. So there is certainly a potential and room for compromise. It will also be interesting because the 2002 law was written in part by House Speaker John Boehner, who at the time was the chairman of the Education Committee. So as a matter of policy, this is an issue that he not only knows a lot about, but cares a lot about, and I think would like to see advanced as part of his own legacy and his own record. So I think that there is genuine interest in it, whether they are able to find common ground on an issue that has become increasingly partisan in recent years, it just remains to be seen. It's too early to know.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Susan Davis, Chief Congressional Reporter for USA Today, about the latest from Congress.
Coming up, we find out what last night's State of the State address might have said about Governor Walker's presidential ambitions.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Last night, Governor Walker gave his fifth State of the State address. A key moment of the speech came when the governor proposed the merging of state agencies like the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority.
Walker also said he's asked the state's new attorney general to work with him on a lawsuit against the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's new rules regarding carbon emissions, saying the rules could hurt Wisconsin manufacturing.
Mike Wagner's here to talk about what was and was not said at last night's State of the State address. Mike's an assistant professor at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, Governor Walker kept it short last night, talking initially about his achievements. Let's hear a little.
If you remember nothing else, remember this. More people are working while fewer are unemployed. State government is more effective, more efficient, and more accountable, and the state's financial condition has improved. Budgets are set based on the public's ability to pay instead of the government's hunger to spend. School scores are up, and more students are graduating. And we are helping more of our fellow citizens transition from government dependence to work. The Wisconsin comeback is working.
Governor Walker there making the case for what he calls the Wisconsin comeback. What did you make about that early part of the speech and the case he made there?
Well, it's sort of part and parcel of State of the State and State of the Union addresses where, you know, the person with the microphone is going to spend some time talking about the great things they've done. And, you know, we saw some of that in the speech. But even then, there weren't a lot of specifics. A lot of times you'll see people in these kinds of situations say we've, you know, created this exact number of jobs. And he did talk here and there in the speech about there are maybe 7,000 or so more jobs than there were before the recession. But there wasn't a lot in the way of meat on the bones of the achievements or what his precise plans are for the next legislative session and his second term.
And something else drawing attention was the length of the speech itself. We're hearing that it clocked in at about 24 minutes. Put that into context. Is that short or is that about right?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think the news media certainly seemed to feel as though it was short, and Governor Walker's general political opponents seemed to say that it was short. I'm not sure how long his other speeches have taken in comparison to this one, but he was about halfway through before he started talking about his agenda for the second term. And so he maybe gave between 8 and 12 minutes to his plans for term number two, which isn't a lot of time. Then again, giving a speech is not the same thing as governing, and you know, the proof will be in what happens in Wisconsin over the next several years.
One thing he did get into a little more as far as policy was his plan to merge state agencies, and that's probably getting the most attention the day after. What did he say last night?
He talked a bit about some things he regularly talks about while campaigning and governing with respect to increasing government efficiency, getting rid of government waste. That's a big theme for Governor Walker. His inaugural address contained a lot of kind of anti-government rhetoric, and the state of the state had a little bit of that, too. And I think that was, kind of the traditional kinds of things we hear from Republican governors and Republican presidents about, government not, being a solution, but a problem.
And is that going to be a hard sell for anyone besides the Democrats? Is this something that should go down easily, go over well with Republicans?
I think Republicans typically prefer that message and, can famously harken back, to Ronald Reagan giving similar kinds of statements and when he was running for office and when he was president during the State of the Union addresses. And, it's the kind of thing that goes over well with Republicans, especially those who vote in presidential primaries.
And how about the merging of agencies? Is that something that will take some time to settle in terms of how both parties feel about it and what gets done?
Yeah, how that works and who keeps and or loses their job or what responsibilities get merged or changed are all things that have to be negotiated. The agencies themselves will obviously have a strong interest in how these negotiations go. Will certain things that they've done go away and not be a part of what government does anymore? Are they really overlapping? These will be things that we'll have to learn about in the legislature, and then they'll make some proposal and pass it or not.
Well, Democrats are pointing to the creation of WEDEC and from the Department of Commerce and saying, well, look, that didn't go over perfectly smoothly. Maybe we should be careful about this. Is that going to be a sticking point this time around?
That always is. State agencies and federal agencies, are very protective of their turf. And we've seen when agencies merge or when leaders want agencies to merge, turf battles start to happen almost immediately. It's very difficult to share information, so it becomes hard to know, are we duplicating services? That kind of stuff becomes difficult to know. President Bush saw that when he created the Department of Homeland Security and bringing in different agencies that had been in different places under one and getting them to communicate, getting them to agree about what their jobs were and were going to be in the future is really challenging. And on a smaller scale, Governor Walker will have a similar challenge.
And there were another couple of agencies that he talked about merging, and one was an agency that oversaw banking and things like that, and also the other, which oversaw physicians and also building safety. Now, at first blush, those don't seem to go together. What do you see as being the end goal of a merger like that one?
We didn't really hear what the end goal was other than create efficiency and eliminate waste and improve accountability. And so that's about as specific as the governor got. And so what purpose that would serve is something that he and his supporters will have to flesh out in the next session.
Maybe falling under the governor's stated intent of improving efficiency is the bottom line at this point.
I imagine. And so we'll have to know, well, what does efficiency mean? How will we know when we've got it? And how will doing this particular merger improve it?
So he's also planning to take on the Environmental Protection Agency, the new rules on carbon emissions. He says he's working with the state's new attorney general. What was your takeaway from that?
I think that's another example of kind of the anti-government rhetoric and legislating, kind of taking on the federal government with its new regulations is another example of what Republicans typically prefer in terms of having states having more rights to behave the way that they want to behave with respect to manufacturing, with respect to the environment in that particular state. The United States is a very diverse place topographically, and so Wisconsin might argue that our needs are different than what the EPA has laid down. At least I imagine that's what the Attorney General and the governor will do as they potentially make their case.
Now, sort of the big picture here is, how do you look at the speech last night in the bigger context and the headlines about Scott Walker these days, which are mostly about whether or not he's going to run for president?
Well, political watchers and pundits and those sorts of folks who watched the speech last night were pretty much unanimous in their conclusions that this is the kind of speech you give if you're going to run for president. Now, Governor Walker has not said he's going to run. He has made some hires for people to kind of explore that possibility for him and to start building an activist network and a donor network and that sort of thing. But he hasn't said he's doing so. But he did not give a speech that was long on detail last night. And it wasn't a very specific speech about the things he wants to do in Wisconsin. Instead, it was a speech talking about how the broad things that he has been a part of in Wisconsin are an example for the country and are an example of how state governments do a better job than federal governments. And he's sort of building the case of, I've led a state, we're doing things better than the federal government. You could easily imagine the next sentence being, and that is why I'm running for president. Whether he does or not, of course, is, you know, up to him.
Would you consider that a clear signal then, what we heard last night? Is it safe to say that the chips are falling on the side of a presidential bid here?
I think the evidence looks more like he's going to run, but until he says so, he's getting what he wants, which is people talking about him potentially running for president.
So keeping it more focused on achievements, not so heavy on the policy and the nitty-gritty there, how does that go over with constituents, people who would vote for him? I mean, do we want to hear more policy, do you think, or do you think that this is what people expect from a State of the State address?
Well, I think, you know, we can think of constituents in a variety of ways. In terms of his supporters, they, you know, have been shown in, you know, survey after survey to have a pretty high degree of trust in Governor Walker. And so if he's not being specific with them in one speech, it stands to reason that his supporters will say, we trust the governor to do the right thing. We voted for him, you know, in some cases three times in the last few years, and we trust him to do the right thing. Governor Walker's opponents will, you know, are almost certainly the most likely to be pointing out there wasn't a lot in the way of detail. There were some points in the speech where he said, you know, that he was kind of going to explain a bold new policy and then there wasn't any explanation exactly of what that might have been. And so, you know, his opponents will say, there's no details. We can't, you know, we can't really know what it is you're up to. And his supporters will say, we can trust him. And he has a track record of delivering on the things he's promised to deliver on.
That's a concern for some people when you have a governor who is possibly running for higher office. Are they going to put their own state on the back burner? And in this case, what does it tend to look like? If we look at other examples, other governors who've run for president, what happens to their state as they do that run?
Well, you get the opponents trying to make the case that they're abandoning that the candidate is abandoning his or her state, the candidate, you know, is leaving them behind for, you know, their own personal ambitions. And we've seen that on both sides of the aisle. We saw it when, you know, Bill Clinton ran. We saw it when George W. Bush ran. And so it's not really a partisan thing. It's the opponent will say the governor is leaving constituents behind. Typically, though, governors who've run for president work pretty hard to make sure that their work is not, you know, kind of falling behind the wayside in their state, and they certainly work hard to make sure their perception is that they are on the ball. Bill Clinton went back to Arkansas during his campaign to preside over an execution, which had, you know, a variety of things he wanted to communicate about being tough on crime and for the death penalty, even though most Democrats aren't trying to appeal to middle of the road voters. And so we'll see that kind of thing if Governor Walker runs as well.
We're talking right now about last night's State of the State address from Governor Walker. Not a lot of policy proposals, but there were some, including the merging of state agencies. Mike Wagner is our guest. He's an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you take away from the State of the State address last night? What do you think about some of the specific ideas, merging state agencies, challenging the EPA on carbon emission rules? And do you see this speech as a sign that Governor Walker will or won't run for governor? Should he or for president? I'm sorry, should he or shouldn't he run for president? Call now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're back with Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. We're talking about last night's State of the State address and what it says for Wisconsin and perhaps the governor's as yet unconfirmed presidential ambitions.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Did you watch, listen to, or read the speech? What did you take away from it? What should the governor's priority be in this term and as he presents a new budget in just a couple of weeks? And
You know, watching this speech, other things the governor's doing, is this a guy getting ready to run for president? Should he or shouldn't he? Call now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
One other thing that came up in the address last night, Governor Walker taking aim at the Common Core. Let's listen.
Tonight, I call on members of the state legislature to pass legislation ensuring objective information is available for each and every school receiving public funds in the state. Provide the information and allow parents to make the choice. No need for bureaucrats or politicians to make that choice. I trust parents.
And the governor there talking about school accountability, which has been much in the news in the last week or so. And along with that, last night, he was asking for some clear standards that did not involve the Common Core. What did you hear last night when it came to schools, Mike?
I heard parents should get the right to choose. That was the main thing, the main theme the governor wanted to discuss. And so parents should get the right to choose in terms of schools. Schools should get the right to choose whether they want to follow Common Core to begin with. It was a lot of kind of individual choice, which is, part and parcel of the governor's political philosophy.
And another issue that came up, taxes. What did the governor have to say when it came to taxes in Wisconsin?
He promised lower property taxes 4 years from now and was hoping to, I think, will continue to work to keep taxes low in other ways over the course of his term. But he took some time to talk about how property taxes were lower now than they were when he took office and how that would also be true in 4 years.
And the Democrats, the Democratic response to what was said last night, what did you hear?
I heard, folks who don't quite, agree with Governor Walker on almost anything. I think you saw a group that is a little smaller than they were in the last legislative session and are, they have fewer potential allies on the other side, as some of the more moderate Republicans didn't run for re-election in the last go round. And so you saw a group that, deeply opposes Governor Walker's political agenda and is working to find ways to oppose it through the legislative process.
Well, go to our phone lines right now. We've got Anthony joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Anthony.
I was just wondering how an elected official who has no background in education can all of a sudden decide how our children in this state are supposed to be educated. I mean, we have a lot more social problems that deal with why schools are failing, but we're not dealing with those, but we're going to go after the teachers and say it's the teacher's fault rather than a house that's in disarray, parents that aren't there. I mean, it's a variety of things. It's not just one thing that's going to solve this problem.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Anthony. Appreciate that. And Anthony, getting at some of the divisiveness around schools, school choice, school accountability, Common Core, all of that right now here in Wisconsin. Some of this is part of a big national picture, too.
It is. It's a part of a national picture, and it's a part of a really big philosophical debate about who should be in charge here and who's at fault. Is it individuals? If you get bad grades, is it your fault? Is it your teacher's fault? Is it your community's fault? Is it the government's fault? Is it some mixture of all of those things? And conservatives tend to look at educators and individuals, and liberals tend to look at societal, kind of broader societal norms and kind of the way society in some places has a lot of resources and in other places doesn't. And they, different people on different sides of the aisle pin the blame on different things, and they don't tend to be in office long enough to be able to exact enough of their philosophy to see if they're really right or if the other side is really right. It's a really, really challenging thing. But the caller is right that a lot of the folks who are making policies about education or anything, healthcare and the like, don't have a background and might benefit from tapping experts' opinions to try to figure out what it is they do, which isn't to say that they don't, but it doesn't get as much attention when they do.
Now, going back to the Democratic response, Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling said she thought that the governor didn't account enough in his speech for the budget shortfall. Of course, you'll be speaking more about that in the budget address in February. But is that typical in a talk like this, in a State of the State address, that the finances are put on hold for later? Or would you have expected to hear more?
You could imagine, and we've seen examples of executives, whether they be governors or presidents, trying to set expectations for the economic medicine that might be to come in the State of the State or State of the Union kind of address, where they might say, we're going to have some hard choices to make. Well, you know, our bills are coming due and we have a deficit before us and we have to find ways to eliminate that deficit or pay down our debt. And we're going to try to save money in these ways, or we're going to try to be more efficient in these ways. And we saw seeds of the efficiency talk in Governor Walker's State of the State address, but not a direct engagement with a potential budget deficit.
Now, the governor is reportedly speaking in Iowa in less than a couple of weeks coming up now. Given that, how would you view this speech? Would you say that he's sort of hitting the pause button, getting ready for that? Or is this all part and parcel of what you'd expect in that lead up again?
Well, if he's running for president, he's doing the kinds of things we would expect him to do, which is to not say that he's running, but not eliminate the possibility, and to talk broadly about accomplishments and not give much in the way of specifics for a second term agenda. And the other kinds of things are lining up. He started to assemble a staff that might serve him if he decides to run. He has said for a long time that if Paul Ryan ran, he wouldn't be likely to run. Congressman Ryan is not going to run for president and said so. And so that also continues to open the door. And so a lot of the things that we've been saying for months, well, if this happens and this happens and this happens, you know, he'll probably run. Those things are starting to happen.
I'm curious if you've noticed anything different in his presentational style. If he were grooming himself for a presidential run, would you expect to see, I don't know, flashier ties, a different speaking style, different hand gestures, or is it just too early for all that?
I think that politicians run a danger of trying to change who they are. Al Gore took a lot of heat when he started wearing brown suits during the 2000 presidential campaign, and there was all these stories about earth tones and Gore trying to change himself. And, you know, Governor Walker knows who he is and, you know, is a capable public speaker and isn't likely to change too much about how he does things. He's talking a lot about his faith, about the military, and about individual freedom in his most recent public addresses, and that's what we would expect of someone who might run for president.
And he's talking about the Packers.
Yes, absolutely. And jabbing Governor Chris Christie, who hugged Dallas Cowboy owner Jerry Jones a couple weeks ago. And Governor Walker said he hugged Packer owners in the crowd at Lambeau last week.
Well, they can only use that, I guess, for so long. Whoever it is, a Packer season could be ending this Friday. So maybe we'll be not seeing quite as much of that.
Well, as a Vikings fan, I'm in favor of that. But, you know, I should probably saddle up with my hometown team.
And the
now.
Game is Sunday, Rob points out. He doesn't want me to get that wrong. The dyed-in-the-wool Packer fan. Well, Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mike Wagner is an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. We've been talking about last night's State of the State address.
If you're looking to get revenge on someone, and who isn't? But you don't want to do any real damage. An Australian company may have the solution. This has been all over the internet this last couple days. They'll send them glitter.
That's right. The website shipyourenemiesglitter.com does exactly what it says. For a fee, they'll send a package of glitter, which I presume just erupts all over the place, to the target of your choice.
Yeah, and at first I thought, well, it's kind of benign. Right, it's glitter.
Glitter.
Shiny, fun. But then you think about, like, have you ever gotten that from the crafty friend or relative, the Christmas card or whatever with the glitter?
Oh, yeah. And that's how you can tell. That's how parents recognize each other. Mm-hmm. You look for the other person with glitter on their face.
From the Kid Craft Project. Uh-huh. Yeah. And it can be like days after the actual glitter-related event and you see that shiny spot in the mirror. And, of course, we had our own back and forth revenge for a while. This is years ago now.
Where you sent me the rotten banana peel in the
mail?
Well,
yeah, after you put a rotten banana peel in my desk drawer. It went back. You know what? Revenge, it hurts everybody, people. Don't do the banana peels. Don't do the glitter. Maybe the glitter.
Good moral.
Yeah, all right. We've learned a valuable lesson.